Okay, so are you ready to go on a little adventure with me today?
Always up for an adventure.
All right, excellent. The Church of Tinkerbell podcast.
Faith, imagination, the power of belief.
Love and acceptance to make the world a better place.
What would happen if we all just tried to see the world through the eyes of a child again, even for a moment?
It's a beautiful thought, isn't it?
It is.
The Church of Tinkerbell.
The Church of Tinkerbell. All right, I'm intrigued. Today, our mission is really to cut through some of the noise and pull out the sharpest insights from some really interesting source material.
Indeed.
We are diving deep into the Church of Tinkerbell's philosophical work, specifically their Evernight series and, well, the really powerful essay within it called Candles Against the Dark.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're maybe encountering the Church of Tinkerbell for the first time, their core philosophy really centers on, radical kindness, whimsy, glitter love, laugh, question.
Right. It's quite a combination.
It is. And they're kind of masters at taking the heavy lifting of modern life and reframing it using accessible, community-focused ritual.
Yeah, making it tangible.
Exactly. And this deep dive, it focuses entirely on how they use the imagery of Halloween, actually, to talk about pretty profound community strength and psychological resilience. It goes way beyond just, candy and costumes.
It really does.
Yeah.
And it's an evolution of their work, you see. The Evernight series, it started more focused on the internal journey, the private shadow work, exploring darkness, grief, transformation within the self.
That inward look.
Precisely. But this essay, Candles Against the Dark, it marks a definitive shift. It takes that individual effort and sort of brings it out onto the street.
Definitely.
The central question it's trying to answer is, what happens when many small lights agree to meet the dark together?
That's a powerful question.
It is. So we're going to unpack the story they use to prove that concept and explore the sort of psychological architecture they believe gets built when neighbors practice collective courage.
Okay, let's get into this core philosophy then, because they immediately redefine the season, don't they? The source says Halloween holds a quieter pulse, not just masks and mischief, but people actually choosing one another, gathering right there at the edge of the dark. They call it an annual rehearsal for collective courage.
And that word rehearsal, I think that's critical.
Oh, why so?
Well, they seem to be suggesting that the casual, maybe low stakes ritual of people walking the streets together on this one night, it's actually preparation.
Preparation for what, though?
For navigating genuine shared crises later on. Practice, practice for trusting visibility, trusting each other.
And the mechanism they propose for this trust, it seems wrapped up in this metaphor. The candle is not the sun, and that's the point. Why is the smallness, the humility of the candle so central here?
Well, what's fascinating is that the candle doesn't try to banish the night entirely. That would be impossible, right? Exhausting.
Like trying to be the sun.
Exactly. The sun demands this big performance of light, but the candle, it just draws a perimeter of honesty, small circle.
That's perimeter of honesty. I like that phrasing.
It creates this circle of warm, sort of workable light where faces can resolve from silhouette to expression. You can actually see each other. And think about it, a spotlight or the sun. That kind of light is often used for surveillance, isn't it?
Yeah.
It demands perfection, exposure.
Right, like you're under scrutiny.
But in the soft, small light of a candle, the source argues, you are visible for mutual care.
Mutual care.
That distinction they make is absolutely crucial. Visibility for care, not for surveillance. Mm. You show up as you are flickering, imperfect, and that's okay. That's enough.
I see that. So the uncertainty, the flickering, that's actually part of the strength, because these community rituals they're talking about, they don't promise to fix everything.
No grand solutions here.
They don't promise to banish the storm, as you said, but they give us shape and stamina. They help us remember how to stand together, maybe?
Precisely. If we're willing to engage in the discipline, the simple act of showing up, even with just a tea light or a short walk down dark street, we're rehearsing.
Practicing that posture.
We're practicing the posture needed for much larger, much harder efforts down the line. And this is what leads to that really incredible insight. It's the true takeaway here. Hope, then, isn't a mood. It's muscle memory.
Hope as muscle memory.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's something you train for through repetition, through gentle exposure. Okay. And to make this concept, this muscle memory idea, really concrete, the essay gives us this vivid example, the story. the candle walk.
Mm-hmm. The proof of concept.
And it didn't start with some big plan, right? No committee meeting. It started with, well, a failure.
A very common failure, too. A storm. It pushes down a transformer on Maple Street late on Halloween afternoon.
Familiar scenario.
Totally. Come dusk, the whole neighborhood is plunged into blackness. No electric pumpkins, no string lights, no brightly lit paths, none of the usual script.
So Mara, the sources say she was the first one.
That's right. Mara steps onto her porch, just a single candle in a mason jar. Not trying to start anything big, just showing up in the dark.
Just being present.
Then Theo, across the street, he sees her, brings out his own light, and Nana Ruth comes out. And she brings her old wedding candles, you know, the kind saved for emergencies.
Wow, the special ones.
Yeah. But the whole thing shifts. It moves from just individual responses to something more like public choreography because of a little kid.
Ah, yes. The kid in the blue cape.
Central to the story. A kid in a blue cape and rubber boots. He wanders out with his mother and asks that really pivotal question.
Do we still do it?
Do we still do it? Looking at the dark houses, maybe just three or four candles flickering across the street.
And the mother's answer is everything.
It really is. She looks around, takes it in, and makes a commitment. We still do it.
That choice, that affirmation of the ritual despite everything.
Yeah, that's what turned the night around. Suddenly, this spontaneous rallying cry, walk with us! It just started hopping from porch to porch.
Organic.
Pure mutual aid, built right there on immediate necessity. We see Ahmed from the corner store suddenly producing a box of tea lights, like out of nowhere.
Just happens to have them.
Right. And then Lena, who maybe didn't have a lot of extra stuff, she strings a simple ribbon between fence posts, clipped paper bags around her candles.
Creating that delicate improvised runway.
Exactly. A runway of light down the street for people to follow. Just simple ingenuity.
I love those specifics because they show you don't need, you know, big budgets or fancy infrastructure for community. You just need permission, maybe, and some creativity.
And willingness.
Yeah.
And as they walked, the story gets even deeper, doesn't it?
Yeah. They started using the candles for more than just light.
They became these physical markers for, well, shared vulnerability.
How so?
The description is quite beautiful. People would touch their candle flames, almost, and softly name them. They named the burdens they were carrying.
Like what?
Things like, for my grandmother, or for the job I lost, someone else said, for the baby we're hoping for.
Wow, that's incredibly intimate for strangers on a street.
It's a moment of profound, quiet honesty. And it seems the darkness actually allowed it, made it feel safer.
Because no one was staring, no spotlight.
Exactly. The source notes that because of this honest proximity, two strangers who weren't strangers anymore smiled so she could see it. The darkness, paradoxically, made the act of being seen less scary.
That's powerful. And of course, we have to talk about the grand finale of the walk, our friend in the blue cape.
Can't forget him.
He goes around placing chocolate, very ceremoniously, into the palm of every adult who stoops down to him. And he declares,
equal candy rights.
Chuckles slightly. It's just perfect, isn't it? And the grown-ups cheered. Not just because it was cute, but because the ritual, invented right there on the spot, created this moment of genuine shared equity. Like, everyone gets something.
It highlights that beautiful potential of shared vulnerability, right? It kind of levels the playing field.
Yeah.
And the story wraps up with this really potent image. Eventually, the power thumps back on. Streetlights glare. But for a moment, nobody moves.
They just stand there.
They blow out their candles. And then they clap. But the source says not for the electricity, but for themselves. For the choice they'd made to be more than their separate rooms.
Clapping for themselves.
They realized in that moment that the darkness had actually made it easier to be a neighborhood.
Wow. Okay, so let's connect that emotional weight back to the bigger picture. Why does this story resonate so much? Why did it become the core of the essay?
Well, the sources really point out that we live amid these durable isolations.
Durable isolations, like what?
Busy schedules, right. All the time spent boxed in screens and that constant draining pressure to perform a kind of perpetual okay.
Oh, that pressure to perform is exhausting.
Yeah.
And it stops us from naming the silent stuff, doesn't it?
Exactly. The griefs we carry, the losses not posted, the fears we've been taught to shoulder alone.
So the story works because it offers a break from that script, a moment of honesty.
Absolutely. The essay really emphasizes that Candles Against Dance the Dark isn't about, you know, aesthetics or trying to recapture some misty past. It's fundamentally about agency.
Agency.
It's about choosing proximity, yeah. Choosing to interrupt that isolating script and, well, risking being known, even in small, ordinary ways.
And I wonder about the social impact of that. You know, when we're isolated, it can feel like we're just data points, an algorithm of preferences, like the source says.
A series of curated likes and dislikes.
Yeah. But when adults show up like this, without guarantees, without knowing exactly what to do, what does that teach us about ourselves?
It teaches us, the source suggests, that we are not an algorithm of preferences, we are a people.
Yeah. From consumer to neighbor.
That shift in perceived identity,
yeah.
Right there, that's maybe the first step in building genuine resilience, moving from isolated consumer to interconnected neighbor.
And think about the kids watching this. What's the impact on children?
Well, when kids see adults practicing this kind of gentle courage in public,
yeah.
You know, stepping out into the dark with just a tiny light, they internalize those scripts.
Scripts are for what?
For facing their own storms,
right.
Later on. It normalizes asking for help, maybe. Or just offering proximity when things go wrong. It shows them how.
It also gives us amazing depth to the simple act of trick-or-treating, doesn't it? That interaction at the threshold.
Yeah, the asking and the answering.
It becomes a form of what they call social magic. You're performing this deeper exchange, will you meet me?
And the answer is yes. Yes, I will. Even if it's just with a piece of candy. It's an agreement to connect.
So how do we take this philosophy, this collective courage idea, and make it actionable? Keeping in mind that the key seems to be practices that are small by design.
Right, replicable. The source actually provides three simple rituals.
Okay, what are they?
First, the candle walk itself. You don't need a power outage to do it.
Hopefully not.
But you do need to make it easy. Pick dusk, maybe set a short loop around the block. And crucially, they suggest providing an optional sentence stem. Something like, I carry this light for.
Why is that sentence stem so important? Couldn't people just, you know, walk and chat?
They absolutely could.
Okay.
But the stem acts as a kind of permission structure.
For what?
For quiet vulnerability. It normalizes it. It gives people a gentle, non-aggressive way to maybe transition from small talk to something a bit more honest, if they choose.
Without demanding a big, deep conversation.
Exactly. It facilitates shared witness without the pressure of performance.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, what's the next one? Porch hour. This one sounds deceptively simple, maybe even a little awkward.
Chuckles. It can feel that way at first glance.
Yeah.
The idea is simple. Households just agree to sit on their porches at the same time, maybe one evening a week in October.
With no agenda, no need to talk to each other.
No agenda required, no socializing required, just presence. The source stresses the point isn't conversation or shared drinks, necessarily. Visibility is the ritual.
Visibility is the ritual.
When neighbors just agree to be visible simultaneously, you break that durable isolation script we talked about. You see people just being mundane, reading a book, watching the sunset, just sitting.
So you see normal life happening nearby.
That shared reality, without any demand attached, makes proximity feel less daunting, maybe more normal.
So it's about breaking the habit of hiding behind closed doors and screens, but without the pressure of, say, hosting a party.
Exactly right. And the final one they suggest is the names and hopes table.
Okay, what's that?
This is a quieter, more contemplative ritual. You use two bowls. One is for names we miss, and the other is for hopes we're tending.
So grief and aspiration.
Mm-hmm. Participants write a name or a hope on a card and leave it anonymously in the correct bowl. Then, maybe later, readers can offer a quiet, collective acknowledgement. Just a simple, we hear you.
Wow, that acknowledges shared grief and shared expectation without needing anyone to make a big public speech about it.
Exactly. It integrates loss and aspiration into community practice gently.
And this all loops back then to that idea that these practices are small by design.
Small means repeatable.
And repeatable becomes reliable.
And reliability, that's how trust grows.
Yeah.
You don't build trust in one huge grand gesture. You build it through lots of reliable small gestures over time.
Little by little.
Mm-hmm. So the overarching work of Evernight, as presented here, seems to be learning how to be a constellation, moving beyond just the solitary effort of carrying your own lamp inside the cave of the self.
From individual lamp to shared constellation.
Yeah. This commitment to shared, gentle ritual. It's really presented as a choreography for what to do with fear.
A choreography. I like that.
We gather. We maybe warm our hands by the small lights. We learn each other's names or burdens quietly. And we practice this kind of ordinary togetherness. the kind that can maybe carry things far heavier than just the burdens October asks of us.
And as we close out this deep dive, it feels right to leave you, the listener, with the final lines of the litany offered in the essay. It's a concluding thought to perhaps carry forward this week.
Night is here. We are here. The dark is honest. Our lights are honest, too.
We name our losses. We name our hopes. We choose one another.
We will walk. We will pause. We will see. We will be seen.
May our small lights teach our hands what to do tomorrow.
It's quite moving.
It really is. And it leaves us with that provocative question the source material poses for your own reflection. What darkness in our community is asking for many small lights rather than a single spotlight?
A question worth sitting with.
Definitely. Something to think about. We'll see you on the next deep dive.
Thanks for going on this little adventure with me today.
Anytime.
And listener, keep sprinkling that fairy dust, all right? We'll see you next time.